Although we are inclined to think that prayer is so common a usage in our modern world that it needs no particular study or investigation, actually, it is one of the most fascinating and little-known subjects in the entire world of man's mental and religious life. The word prayer, coming, of course, from the Latin precari, means to entreat, to implore, or to beseech. Yet in practical usage, this has not been its meaning in a great many instances. And in order to focus the subject in our modern way of life, we need some background about the development of man's concept of communication between himself, nature, spirit, divinity, powers, and perhaps the deity itself. All of these stages and steps, all of these different attitudes, are of concern to the anthropologist and the ethnologist because they bear upon the rise of human culture. It is now generally acknowledged that we cannot be sure how and where and when religion, as we know it, first appeared in this world. We are not able to assume that it was merely a revelation at some time indicated by the dating of ancient scriptures. We realize that it began as a psychological relationship between man and his world. A man's attitude toward the world around him has changed greatly in the course of ages. Yet in this world today, many of the older attitudes still survive, mingling in varying degrees with more recent interpretations. Nor do the old attitudes survive mostly among primitive people. They may appear in various colorings in all parts of our society, so that we are forced to consider them as factors here and now in the interpretation of our spiritual existence. At a very ancient time, man came into conflict with nature. The conflict arose partly from the individuation that was arising in man, a process whereby he became the immediate manager of his own affairs, and the regularities, rhythms, and periodicities of natural order. Man wanted what he wanted when he wanted it. Nature did not exactly agree with this policy. Nature provided according to seasons and times. And natural processes were subject to certain irregularities, certain inevitable interruptions or inconsistencies, which might be measured in terms of unseasonal weather, or the failure of water supplies, or earthquakes, plagues, and pestilences. Man confronted not only with the rhythms of nature, but with these exceptional breaks in natural rhythm, he came to a degree exasperated. He was unhappy about the whole thing, and he began to conceive of ways and means by means of which he could force his own will upon nature, molding it not by his works, but by his words or his thoughts, and by magical formulas. At the very beginning, it seems that man's religious relationship with nature was a relationship with himself primarily. Thus, in primitive tribal custom, religious ritualism is what we would term non-directive. The rain dance calls for rain. It really does not care very much how the rain arrives or where it comes from. Ritual was man expressing his own needs, but not originally directing these needs toward any particular deity or any particular structure of religious hierarchy or pattern. The individual seemingly expressed himself, relieved his own nature of certain anxiety, and he was addressing rain as rain, as though the water could hear him, as though the skies would listen. There was also, in many instances, not even a very reverent attitude in this primitive ritual. Some very simple statements can be found in the old rites, in which those wanting rain simply stood up and said, "Rain, come," and waited, as though they had issued an order. On other occasions, they would say, "Plague, go away." Now, apparently, Plague was better mannered than they were and did not listen to this type of conversation. Apparently wanted a more polite form. So as time went on, people didn't say any longer, "Plague, go away." They might say, "Father Plague, please leave us." Plague now became involved as a being. And antiquity inevitably personalized everything. Finally, rain became a being. Wind became a deity. In some parts of Asia, a rather sprightly gentleman with a large bag on his back filled with air. All these concepts became personalized, and the individual more and more addressed himself to these personifications of attributes. He spoke to rain as though it would answer, as though it understood, as though it could be affected by his thinking. At this level, we have a theological problem of considerable delicacy, because actually prayer can only be understood when we estimate the relationship between the person praying and the object to which the prayer is addressed. If man turns himself to an infinitely superior being, one who is all-knowing, one who possesses all powers and all means for the accomplishment of ends, then man naturally addresses this superior, this infinite being, in a manner indicating human humility. We cannot force ourselves upon that which is infinitely greater than ourselves. We must petition. So if the concept of deity was that of a remote, all-powerful, all-perfect being, then prayer took the form of supplication or entreaty. But there were many times in our spiritual life when deity did not occupy this relationship to the human mind, when deity was not infallible, not infinitely remote. Deity was rather a very close and proximate being, with attitudes and temperament much like that of a human being. Under such conditions, man bargained with God. And there are a great many people today who do the same thing. They sit down as they might with another businessman and try to work it out, arbitrating some program which can go all the way from a most childish effort to barter and a means so dignified that its essential structure is lost sight of. If, for example, we light a candle when we pray, we are in a measure bargaining. We are making an offering for which we expect a dividend. If we say in our prayer, if this prayer is granted, I will do this, that, and the other thing, then we are also bargaining. I know many cases, actually, in which individuals have said, by way of prayer, if you will take this sickness from me, I will be good from now on. This is bartering, although it is done in a nice way. Or if we say, if this misfortune is removed, then I will contribute to some worthy charity. This type of thinking and praying is not unfamiliar in our day. It represents the fact that we agree to give something if we get something. Now, this might look as though it was a rather nice modern invention, but it is really a fine old established custom among the Australian bushmen. So we are not especially rare or rich in our particular attitude. At some time, also, we developed a kind of superiority complex in primitive days. And we began to take an attitude of man over nature, later to be developed into the concept of mind over matter. Well, that is exactly what its substance was. The belief that by demand, by one of 100 different magical means, we could force our own will upon circumstances. Anciently, we hardly had the self-confidence to do this without some recourse to magic. But later, these magical methods became merely philosophical convictions or defenses of policy. But we gradually developed this idea that we could change the outer surface or likeness of life by demand, supported in any way that we might feel that we are entitled to support these demands. Also in this time, we began to develop in early non-Christian faith this curious concept that man was a unique creature. This concept very distinctly and definitely influenced prayer. In the ancient times, particularly in the theological periods of history, man was not regarded as a generation emerging with nature. He was not the highest of the mammals, as we categorically classify him today. Man was something apart. The world was made for his convenience. The stars were hung in the sky so that he could see at night. Everything centered around man. All other creatures were merely to serve him. Some to supply him their bodies for food or their skins for clothes. Man had no responsibility. He was a kind of a little autocrat on a desert island in space, entitled to anything that he could get, and perfectly privileged to do as he pleased with everything he had. Now, it would be natural, with this point of view, that our attitude toward our needs would not be exactly reverent. More to the point was our general attitude that whenever we did not get what we wanted, some universal force was trying to cheat us out of our birthright. We were not supposed necessarily to deserve anything. We were supposed to reach out and pick it from the tree. If some wind blew it off before we could pick it, and we were left without this particular desired object, then the bottom was out of the universe. And we turn to the universe not to ask, but in anger, to reprimand nature for having failed to provide us with what we wanted. Our attitude was therefore what we might call childish. We looked upon nature as merely existing as a great mother servant for us to use as we please. It didn't take long to develop from this a rather highly evolved and involved ethical concept. Namely, that man was created by God with the right to have anything he wanted. If he didn't have it, it was simply because he hadn't asked for it loud enough and long enough. Also, if he was not able to enjoy all of this world's good, it was no matter of his own character, no problem involving defect in himself. He simply had not demanded what he wanted, and he had not gone out and taken it. This led, of course, to a number of complications, including the justification of war, rape, and pillage. It became more or less the basis of the more refined utterance of some of our to the left of center political parties in the last century, "The world owes me a living. The world owes us anything we want." And we may go as far as to say that certainly we should be entitled to it, but no matter what we get, would hardly pay for the inconvenience of being here in the first place. Actually, under such condition, prayer more or less merely became an affirmation of our own conviction about something. It lost all entreaty. It lost all sense of our own dependence or our own need. It simply became a positive statement of what we wanted. And then we waited breathlessly for it to arrive. If it did not arrive, we changed to another denomination that could deliver more quickly. These policies men have played with for thousands of years, trying to work out a proper and reasonable attitude toward the needs of life and how to acquire them. Further than this, you have to realize that most ancient religions were polytheistic, and while we do not reasonably like to admit it, much of their philosophy and tradition has descended to us, to our own faiths and to our philosophies built around different faiths. In polytheism, we began to develop the idea of specialized deities. Deities held control over certain attributes of nature. There were gods of all degrees and levels, visible and invisible. These deities had some relationship to a great over-hierarchy. Most of the more advanced religions assumed that this over-hierarchy was finally and ultimately suspended from a single divine power. But the deity, manifesting through creation, manifested through orders of life. Many of these orders superior to our own, and constituting the hierarchies of St. Paul. It became, therefore, important to worship certain deities for certain purposes, or with certain ends in view. In ancient times, the guilds, or the great corporations of workmen, had their own deities. The god of medicine was peculiarly worshipped by the physician or by the sick seeking recovery. The god of harvest was also given his sacred days and his rites and rituals. Various deities ruled storms and rivers. There were gods of cities. And in the siege of Troy, we remember how the deities fought in heaven, while the heroes combated on the earth below. Trades and professions, arts and crafts, all had their deities. And the primary responsibility of the member of each of these groups was to worship the deity of his group. He assumed that this deity would protect him against inroads from other deities, or would see that his particular estate was protected for him. Out of this came gradually a sort of hierarchy of demigods, beings between men and the divine power above. These demigods and heroes could be prayed to, much as ancestors were. And of course, in Greece and later in Rome, the rulers took on the divine prerogative, so that the emperor of Rome was not only the head of the state, but a deity, under the concept of emperor worship. The emperor, of course, was not the primary deity, not the great deity overall, but a deified mortal, like the emperor of China in the old days, or the Dalai Lama of Tibet. A being sacrosanct, set apart from other mortals, to whom prayers could be addressed, and who was believed to be able to actually produce or bestow spiritual benefits. Even in Europe, this habit continued throughout the period of absolute monarchy. And there are records of the divine right of kings as late as the 17th and 18th centuries. And the king as the god physician was an interesting phenomenon. We know that this continued in England and Scotland down past the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. So that each year the king set aside a day in which the sick could come. And as he could not touch them all with the royal touch, which was not in that day a tax lien, but a benefit, the king prepared what were called touch coins. Resembling money, but created for a purpose. These were distributed to the sick after the king had blessed them or touched them himself. And these coins carried the benefit of the royal prerogative. And in Scotland and Ireland today, these coins are cherished from one generation to another and have been used for sickness as late as the last 2 or 3 years. The belief that they had certain divine power descending from the divine right of kings, a right which was supposed to have been established in heaven. Naturally, the end of what you might term absolute monarchical autocracy ended this concept very largely, although there are still vestiges of it in Japan and in some other countries, Siam. The demigods began to disappear in the more enlightened concepts of religion for them was substituted the arhats in Buddhism or the lohans, the sanctified apostles, and in Christendom, the apostles, the apostolic succession, and the canonization of saints. The saint being, in most instances, associated with some peculiar virtue which could be attained through supplicating that saint. Therefore, prayers to saints were for particular purposes or to attain some special end associated with the life or martyrdom of that saint. But it has been universally held in the older forms of Christianity that these sanctified persons could and did intercede for the true believer, and that prayers addressed to them might be answered. Thus we have so many different variations of the prayer theme that we have to recognize that each of these differences affects to some degree the attitude of the person praying, involving a different kind of concept as to the right to pray, the correct manner to pray, and the attitude that we should take if the prayer is not answered. In the penitenti villages of New Mexico, the little saints, the little wooden figures of the saints that are called the bultos, or wooden figure, are prayed to. One of the most familiar of these little saints in the homes of these primitive worshippers is San Jose, or St. Joseph. And it is not uncommon to find that if this saint does not answer the prayer that is asked of him, he is punished by having his face turned to the wall for several weeks until he repents of his thoughtlessness and indifference. It is necessary to punish the saint because he did not do what we wanted him to. This tendency to punish the saint survives more subtly in a great many of our attitudes today. Prayer also involves a very profound psychological question that began at the very beginning. And that is, how does it happen that all prayers are not answered? We can abstractly theologize on this subject and try to explain why 10 persons whose prayers are answered will be followed by 10 more whose prayers are not answered. A very serious situation of this nature can surround some famous healing shrine like that at Lourdes in France. If the sick person goes to Lourdes and is healed, it is a wonderful evidence of divine blessing, but supposing he is not healed. The philosophy of prayer must be large enough to explain this peculiarity. And this peculiarity, obviously, was noticeable from the very beginning. Sometimes prayers produced the desired result. Sometimes they did not. Now, there were many explanations offered for these. Some groups held that the deities to whom they prayed were too much like themselves. Therefore, that these deities did not answer prayer because they didn't like the person who prayed, or because the person did not put out the right offering on the little table before the spirit of the deity. That there was some mistake in the rite or the ritual, some error in formula, some important detail had been overlooked, some ancient and mysterious formula had been misinterpreted, and for such causes the prayer was not answered. But out of it all came the final development of man's guilt mechanism. It ultimately came to be rather obvious to him that his own prayers were not always honest. And he began to suspect that his own integrity had something to do with whether or not the prayer was answered. And in the rise of Christianity and in more recent centuries, the emphasis has been upon the element of faith. The individual whose faith is not strong will not receive benefit. The individual whose faith is great will receive benefit. And on this, the faith also rests upon the testimony of Jesus in the gospel. So that the answering of prayer depends upon the attitude of the person praying. Whether this attitude is sincere, whether it is morally right, whether the prayer is morally and spiritually good, whether the person is asking for something that is contrary to his real spiritual need. If his prayer is selfish, if it is ulterior in its motive, if his own attitude is not sincere, then perhaps this will explain why the prayer is not answered. But there became further evidence that apparently the most sincere persons were not successful. And we come into the same problem that has beset us ethically for a long time. Why is it that the sincere seem to suffer, whereas the insincere flourish like the green bay tree? This apparently led to the conclusion that there had to be elements present in the entire formula of man's existence that were beyond his understanding. Therefore, in the presence of mystery, which appeared to be unjust or unreasonable, man could only take the attitude that his own ignorance prevented him from understanding, and that actually only deity itself who knew what was truly good. And these things rested with the arbitrary power of God to grant or deny, first according to his pleasure, and later according to the laws and principles which he represented. This brings again another situation to common thought, and that is the structure of the prayer form as we know it now and as it anciently developed. Prayer was, as we have said, originally non-directive. It was the dance, the ritual, the chant, and the song. It was the individual fulfilling certain ancient rituals associated with magic and calculated to bring the results that were required. Later, this ritualism, which was really only possible when man had a certain ethical concept toward nature, this ritualism took on greater ceremonial proportions and became directive as man began to sense the rising of a great spiritual power at the root of existence. When man became conscious of a God separate and apart from his own concept, when he began to realize the existence of a universal parent principle, above and beyond the small and passing interests of man, then the relationship of the dance and the magical formula to this deity changed, and we begin to find the rise of the spirit of entreaty. We find man trying to bridge the interval between his own existence and this measureless and immense life in space. Man only believed that the final residing place of the supreme power was space, the air around him. If deity was all-knowing and all-aware, and deity was all-available at all times, then this deity had to be azonic. It had to be a power that did not reside in one place, but resided everywhere. It had to be something near but unseen. And as the Incas of Peru realized it, they performed a religious ritual of honoring God by kissing the air as an indication that they believed it to be his residing place or where they could reach to him. Thus words spoken into the air, songs sung into the air, dancing with music, the beating of drums, vibrating through the air. These were means of communicating with the divine power. Also incense and smoke of offering rising into the air was raised and lifted up unto the nostrils of the Most High. So deity dwelt in the air dimension, in a dimension beyond our sight, but always near to us. In this same concern, man gradually polarized his concept of the world in which he lived. In the Chaldean time, Babylonian, early Egyptian, Phoenician, ancient Chinese, in all these old times, man began to divide the world between an upper and lower region of air or place. Nature, the earth, mortality, man, always implied the concept of down. Man looked down to the earth, and when his life was over, he went down to sleep in the earth. Man looked up into space. Space was mystery. Space was filled with remote and wonderful things like stars. In the air above him, the sun marched its ancient course. In the air above him also, the clouds came. The air was light. The earth was dark. Light came with day. Darkness came with night. And by degrees, man instinctively developed this concept of the upness of superior things and the downness of inferior things. Way back in the days of the Chaldeans and Phoenicians, therefore, men lifted up their eyes unto the hills from whence cometh their strength. Many primitive people believed that their gods dwelt upon mountains, or in the high places of the Lord, even as it was upon a mountain that God spake unto Moses. So mountains and mountain worship became very sacred. And the concept of the world mountain, whether it be Olympus or Meru or Sumeru, these mountains, like Kailasa, the abode of the gods of India, had at their tops and highest parts invisible temples, forever clouded and hidden from the view of men, where dwelt the immortals. Men thus began to pray upward. They began to raise their hands in supplication. They began to address the air or the sun, or like the devout Muslim, they faced Mecca and raised their hands to the sky. This raising of the hands was a salutation, a greeting, a calling upon the air to bear witness. And even today, in many religious groups, it is customary to raise the face in prayer, as though looking with the eyes closed into some place in space. On the other side of the story, humility, penance, of man's recognition of his own sinful and imperfect nature may cause him to hang his head in shame. Therefore, prayer in which the head is lowered is inclined to indicate humility, regret for offense, humbleness, and that the individual hangs his head as a criminal before the judge because he has sinned and because he is asking for forgiveness for the frailties and limitations of the flesh. These moods became gradually psychological. No longer do we actually associate them with any conscious act. We simply fall into traditional forms and formulas. Things have always been done this way. Therefore, we continue to do them this way. Prayer, however, gradually divides in our thinking between man raising his eyes to the light, a man hanging his head in despondency and chagrin. These two moods have always distinguished the basic elements of our attitude toward prayer in religion. Beginning with the Protestant Reformation, there has been a drift away of the churches from the use of prayer as an instrument of healing. We know, for example, that the early church regarded among the explicit instructions of the Master to his disciples his words, "Heal the sick." For the last 500 years, however, such healing has been either through the intercession of saints or through sacred places like Lourdes or the shrine at Guadalupe, or perhaps in a lesser measure through congregational prayer, sometimes included in Protestant services when a member of the congregation is stricken. But the formal concept of religion as a healing agency and the development of the admonition of the Master to his followers, these procedures have been generally and almost totally neglected. One of the reasons for the neglect has probably been the rapid rise of our materialistic sciences and also the rapid division between the arts of medicine and religion. In ancient times, there was no such division, and therefore the priest and the physician were frequently the same person. More recently, however, the division has not only been clearly marked, but a powerful antagonism has arisen between these two groups. And with the rise of science, the attitude of learning in general has not favored the continuance of any mystical type of healing. Man has been taught to depend more and more upon the pharmacopoeia, upon scientific methods of combating disease. I imagine that in the course of the perspective of future centuries, we will find that the 19th century of our era was the dividing line. For in the 19th century, materialism sort of hit bottom. It descended as far as it could into a state of sophisticated isolation. Learning separated itself from almost every intuitional and mystical attribute of human character. We became so fascinated with the exactness of scientific procedure, we forgot that this exactness can be, and usually was, extremely sterile. It's not much comfort to us to know the exact reason why things go wrong. But what we are more concerned with is the exact method by which we can set them right. It consequently follows that we learned a great many facts, but many of these facts had little effect upon our happiness, our health, or our peace of mind. But the broad attitude which accompanied this factual approach worked a hardship on all. It worked a hardship upon our health as well as upon our internal convictions. So by the end of the 19th century, we began to revise our thinking. And with the rise of psychology, we entered into a new era of interpretation concerning things once held as religious or mystical or mysterious. It gradually dawned upon us that all of the reports of the past dealing with the power of prayer, that these were not all imaginary. Of course, in the medieval period, we always had the devil to blame for trouble. We are gradually disposed of him, but we are still in trouble, which indicates that probably he was not the cause in the first place. Actually, the mysteries that we could not understand were not infernal, demoniacal, or due to some extraordinary magical formula. these mysteries were simply the result of man being what he was. And among these mysteries, it became evident that there was a scientific means of explaining why prayer helped people to get well. Now, this, however, was a sort of mixed blessing in itself, because psychology was, especially at that time, itself tightly held in the bonds of materialism. The psychologist simply elevated the mystery of prayer to the level of mental phenomena. But he did accomplish one very useful end. He proved conclusively that this mental phenomenon was valid, that it accomplished its purposes, and that it was perfectly possible for an individual to enjoy almost miraculous changes in his condition and estate as a result of the positive statement of faith in his own consciousness. The psychologist at that time might question whether this faith itself was justified or not, but they could not doubt that the faith, when firmly held, produced positive results. This, however, still left the whole subject as one no longer of magic, but of auto-suggestion, of the individual influencing his own conduct and setting up a pattern whereby, through the increased confidence given to him by the belief in prayer and by the survival of the magical ritual of addressing his needs to the mysterious air around him, that actually he was helped, that something happened, things changed. And the psychologist said, yes, they changed, but the change was due to the change in you. Now, this was not quite as materialistic as it first appeared, because if we will remember and go back to religious origins, particularly of our own faith and the more prominent religions of other people, all good things were reserved in religious doctrine for those who did change themselves. St. Paul refers to those who were the firstborn of them that sleep. He describes those that are born again in Christ. That the individual passes through certain internal experiences, and if he is sanctified by these experiences, if he is impelled to a new degree of inner integrity, he gains thereby a certain power over circumstances. Psychology toyed with this idea. It, however, held mostly and largely to the conclusion that it was the intensity of the attitude, rather than the validity of it, which produced the result desired. And as one defense for this position, the psychologist pointed out that while we regard our faith as so and true and proper, we also have very grave doubts about the accuracy of other people's believing. Yet other people, having other believing, also have their prayers answered. And just as many pagans have had their prayers answered as Christians, just as many Buddhists as Hindus, just as many Chinese as Jews. Therefore, prayer to be answered does not necessarily imply that we have to belong to one religion or one theological system, even though we sometimes wish to deny the validity of these other systems and insist theologically that the followers of them are deluded. Still, these deluded people have just as good luck with their prayers as we do. And it is also notable that the rain falls upon both the just and the unjust. Thus, we have a further situation to consider. And psychology left this side of it rather flat. They admit it, and we will all acknowledge with them that an individual moved by a conviction is changed. and is changed from within himself. And there is no conviction that can move him more than the conviction that God is on his side. There are not many of us who follow Abraham Lincoln's recommendation to find out whether or not we are on God's side. We assume that because we assume, as do children, that our parent wants us to be happy. Therefore, whatever makes us happy, God will bestow. It is adolescent, but we still cling to it. Realizing that strength of mind over matter, and the strength of mind over our own conduct, or over our own attitude, will produce marked changes in the chemistry of our relationships. The mentalists began to study prayer as mental phenomena, as suggestion, auto-suggestion, and almost hypnosis. The element of prayer as magic was, of course, eliminated at this stage of the thinking. So the point was developed very strongly that the individual who was without center, who was in chaos or confused or disoriented, such an individual would, if through prayer, he could regain a certain sense of centeredness, immediately begin to free himself from difficulties. He would find his association with other people more pleasant. And because he became a better organized and more direct and clear-thinking person, innumerable problems began to clear. And among other problems, naturally, his economic situation, which has been the subject of a great deal of prayer in the last 100 years, began to improve and clear up also. All he had to do was to convince himself of certain things. He had to convince himself that God wanted him to be happy. He had to convince himself that God wanted him to be rich. He also had to convince himself that God wanted him to be healthy. If he could achieve these ends in form of conviction, then he was in a good way to achieve many of the things which he desired. Ethically, the weakness in the whole situation lies in the fact that we have no evidence that Deity wants these things. We assume, however, that because Deity is good, Deity wants us to have what we want. The question as to whether this is good or not does not come into the subject at all. What we want must be good. What we do not want must be bad. Thus, for many years, prayer and associated religious contrivances began to get rather selfish and essentially self-centered. Psychology began to experience the reaction of this in its own cases. It discovered that people, taking various attitudes which are comparable to prayer, and intensely expecting, which was this phase, no longer beseeching, but expecting, that when these people got what they expected, they merely got more trouble. It did not work out well. The individual believed he had found a magic formula for success. But this success did not touch himself. This success was without humility. It was without this basic beseeching, which was so large an element in the entire history of prayer from the very meaning of the word itself. The word prayer does not mean demand. It means to entreat, to beg, to ask. But through various philosophies, we elevated ourselves to such a near kinship with God that it was no longer necessary for us to beseech anything. We could talk it all over man to man. That was our trouble. In trying to raise ourselves up, we pulled God down until we were finally confronted again with this arbitration problem, this problem of variously bargaining for the things which we wanted. And this bargaining went right on into the present century. Psychology, therefore, came to the realization gradually that prayer, as we had been popularly practicing it, was not essentially therapeutic. It did not result in healing. It did not change the person. It merely permitted him to use one group of faculties more intensely than he had previously used them, and from this greater intensity to achieve certain distinct and greater results. It being assumed, of course, that these results were right and proper, and that the development of these faculties was the reasonable and normal way by which man grew and unfolded. With the beginning of the 20th century, new dimensions again came in. Psychology began to drift away from its utter materialism. It began to break into smaller schools, and some of these schools are still segmenting. They are still breaking into still smaller groups and divisions. Others are clustering around new central concepts. But out of it all is gradually emerging probably the most philosophical attitude that we have in general today, namely that there can be no permanent improvement in man without certain interior changes in man. If the individual simply cannot will his way to reality or will his way to safety, he may be able to add to his means. He may be able to force himself into some situation not otherwise immediately available. But regardless of where he goes, what he does, what he has, he still remains pathetically what he is. And what he is not satisfactory to anyone involved in this problem. In the last 25 years, wars and depressions have resulted in a strong restatement of basic religious convictions. And in the last 10 years particularly, the reintroduction of healing into the structure of Christian religions